expecting heavy downpours all day today.
You're a builder. You build. It's literally in your job title.
Woo! Let's hit it.
A little rain isn't stopping you. Not today, not any day. Shouldn't your flashing tape be working through it all too? Only Frog Tape Pro Grade Flashing Tape's high-performance acrylic adhesive sticks, re-sticks, and stays stuck, even on the roughest surfaces in rain, snow, heat, and more. So you stay in control when it matters most. Show weather who's boss with Frog Tape Pro Grade Flashing Tape.
Hi, I'm Mike Dilk, and you're listening to the Relax Back UK Show, the show that explores all kinds of health topics relevant to you, your family, and your friends. Each week, I talk to expert guests from a range of backgrounds to inform and entertain you. So please do join the Relax Back UK family and stay tuned.
Hi, and thank you for joining me on this week's Relax Back UK show. The topic today is one that affects a lot of men.
You bend down, you're looking at a cabinet, the camera's on you, you can certainly see this great big bald spot and the top of the hair thinning.
It is thinning hair, and my guest is bargain hunt celebrity Thomas Forrester, who was worried about his receding hairline and thinning hair and decided to do something about it. So he contacted hair transplant surgeon Chris D'Souza, who carried out quite an involved procedure for him.
Each follicle goes into one incision. So Thomas had, I believe, sort of 2,200 grafts. So that would be 2,200 incisions. And each follicle is inserted into one incision.
Stay tuned to find out what could be done to help if you're worried about losing your hair. Thank you. So the guests today are Thomas Forrester of Bargain Hunt and Chris D'Souza, a hair transplant surgeon. And I started really by exploring with Thomas what led him to take the course of action of actually going for a hair transplant.
I'm kind of fascinated by this whole subject. And so, Thomas, if I may, I'll start with you. So you've had a hair transplant.
Yes.
You're successful. You've got a family. Everybody loves you. So the question's got to be, why? Take me through the thought process.
I like that everybody loves me. I don't think that's the case.
Well, it's true, isn't it?
So why? Well, it was something I have thought about and explored since my mid-40s, and yes, there was a stage, you know, I turned 40, good head of hair, Scott, you know, mid-40s, and suddenly it was like tactical withdrawal. It was rapidly receding, and my crown was very exposed. As you know, I'm on Bargain Hunt, I'm on, you know, I do other television, and yes, when one watches one's back, and you know, that's without any sense of helping, you know, you bend down, you're looking at a cabinet, the camera's on you, you can certainly see this great big bald spot and the top of the hair thinning.
The makeup artist starting to put makeup elsewhere than on your face, kind of dabbing a bit on the top to stop glare.
Mike, this is the BBC. This is Bargain Hunt. There is no makeup artist. No. And basically, it was something which I was considering. And I have always enjoyed, you know, I'm not a thin human being. I think that thinning hair on a larger man, and I would class myself as slightly rotund, is quite a confidence thing, really. So being slightly bigger, even though I try very hard not to be, and having a bald head, I didn't fancy that, to be candid. It wasn't okay. Good for my self-esteem.
All right, no, fair enough. I get it. So I'm 57, and I don't suffer from walking down the street, people stopping me for autographs and all that. I blend in completely, and you know, my hair is thinning. I suppose it doesn't affect me. I'm pretty lucky. This is a very clumsy way of saying, had you thought of having a chat with your mates down the pub or seeing a counsellor or something? Because if there was something missing, maybe you could fix it in a slightly less sort of invasive, potentially painful way.
No, I hadn't considered that. No, it was, I suppose, Mike, the way I thought about it was actually a bit more preventative. You know, I wasn't completely bald. I was thinning, but actually if I had the procedure done now rather than wait, it would be better to have it done now. I've retained the hair I had before, and I wasn't shedding any more. But instead of having that complete transformation of having no hair to then having lots of hair, I thought actually this was the better way forward to do it. Yeah. in a subtle approach.
No, I get it. Well, it certainly suits you, and it's worked. So, you know, I haven't put my video on, so you can't see my receding hairline, but I can see you, and you look great. So, you know, it certainly worked. Let's bring in Chris, and if we can, maybe explain the process a little bit. So you're a hair transplant surgeon. The idea of surgery kind of automatically kind of fills me with a bit of dread. I mean, is it under a general anaesthetic? Explain the process.
Yeah, so hair transplant surgery is almost always done in one, well, in our clinic, always done in one day, mostly entirely sort of under local anaesthetic. So the area is numbed up, so local anaesthetic injected, similar to the dentist, so some sharp stings when it goes in. The area goes numb, and you are really moving hair from one place to another. So hair transplant surgery really utilizes the fact that the back and sides of the scalp don't seem to be affected by, you know, male pattern hair loss. So that hair is sort of referred to as sort of in the permanent zone, and you're moving hair from the back and sides to often the top or the crown. Right. So it's that sort of, you know, natural result where we get sort of increased density in the areas required.
So what do you do? You take them out one at a time or a clump, and then kind of tell us.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's two techniques. So FUE, so that's follicular unit excision. So that's the technique which Thomas had. So that's where you're taking them out individually one by one. So we use a tiny punch, maybe 0.9, 0.95 millimetres in diameter, and you're punching out each graft individually. But each graft is actually not only one hair, but it can be, you know, two or three hairs. So those are the sort of follicular units. And you're moving them one by one to, you know, often the front or the crown. And then there's the other technique, linear strip excision. So that's where you take a thin strip of skin, and then that strip is dissected under the microscopes to do pretty much the same thing as FUE at the top, in the fact that you're, you know, sort of recreating the hairline or increasing density where you need to.
That one sounds a little more involved. You're taking off a strip of skin, dissecting it, and putting it in.
Yeah. So, I mean, linear strip excision, I guess, you know, that we still do that. About sort of 15-20% of our cases are still linear strip excision, and it can be very good for larger cases or for cases where, you know, patients don't want to cut their hair at all. But follicular unit excision certainly has become more popular, and yeah, I mean, it's a more flexible surgery for sure, because it allows you to wear your hair shorter in the future. But both techniques are, you know, are still relevant.
Yeah, but I mean,
I think, Mike,
go ahead,
can
Thomas.
I just cut in, Chris? So with mine, when Chris punched out the hair from the donor from the back and the sides, then what's so interesting is his team is there, and they're dividing them all up, because, you know, your hair, the follicles, if I'm right, Chris, is that some will have one hair in, some will have two, three, fours, and rarely fives. Some mm-hmm. they're, you know, with five little strands of hair. And so these guys, they're like artists, right? And they've got them all in different petri dishes, haven't you? Yeah,
yes.
all being kept, you know, in as they're taking them out, and the guys are in them with their microscopes, looking at ones with twos, threes, and fours. And then the art of the surgeon, Chris, is then thinking, right, well, where do we place them? And that's his one of his brilliant skills.
Okay, so you've got a hair follicle from a clump of three, four, or five. You take one. You've got it in your tweezers, Chris. What next? How do you get it into Thomas's head?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Yeah, so I mean, they're placed in with forceps. So essentially, there's sort of three steps really when it comes to hair transplant surgery. You know, number one, I suppose, is the incision making. So that's where the grafts are going to go. So that's, you know, me essentially deciding on the angulation, the depth, and the density. The second step is taking those grafts out safely. And as Thomas said, the surgical assistants are under the microscope looking at each one of those follicles individually, sorting them into ones, twos, and threes. And then the final step is slotting them in. And obviously that should be done.
You don't slot each of those into an individual hole. You make an incision and then put two or three little clumps into each incision or something.
No. Each follicle goes into one incision. So Thomas had, I believe, sort of 2,100 grafts. So that would be 2,200 incisions. And each follicle is inserted into one incision.
Wow. You say this is like one day surgery. This sounds like a long day to me.
It is. It is a long day. I mean, we start at 9, maybe finish at 4:30, 5. So it's a long day for sure. But the results are great. I mean, the way hair transplant surgery has evolved from plugs, where it used to be sort of 4-centimeter round, sort of big plugs. And that's what gave that sort of doll's hair appearance. But now, because it's all done, you know, on a very sort of micro scale of, you know, 0.9 millimeter round punches, then, you know, that's how you get the nice sort of natural and subtle results.
Sure, I get it. Now, is the hair on your head kind of different depending where it grows? So if you take hair from, you said, the sides, it tends to stay, and put it somewhere where it tends to disappear, do you end up with sort of slightly different sort of hair? So it looks a bit different and feels a bit different?
No, I mean, the scalp from the back and sides is you know, comparable, not pretty much the same to the front. I mean, the key in getting a natural result is to use those ones, twos, and threes effectively. So the hairline, you know, is comprised of sort of one haired follicle, so nice and soft and irregular, slightly asymmetrical. And then the density is built up with the twos and threes. So that's the difference really between, you know, a good transplant and a poor transplant.
So in your case, Thomas, when you had this over sort of 2,000 hair follicles or clumps of hair follicles put in a different place, did they all stay there, or did some of them fail and kind of fall out after a little while?
Well, the thing is, I had this done in December, so we're now 6 months in, and 6 to 8 months in, I suppose, one would say, being August, you could say that there is a 50 to 60% take up right now. And 100% will be in 12 months' time. And then in 18 months, we'll have another, you know, there's the key milestones, as Chris will say. No, I mean, I looked, the thing is, the most important thing is after the surgery, you have to have, you know, 2 weeks of basically sitting. You know, you cannot fiddle with it. You know, you could wash your hair slightly after the first 4 or 5 days, but you cannot and should not, you know, do anything. After those 2 weeks, you're fine.
I see. Okay. So that it's kind of bedding in and getting happy in its new home.
Yeah, absolutely. No, 100%. But no, when Chris was saying, so each follicle, so some might have, you know, it's probably a bit like some might have one hair, two hairs, or three hairs. So that each follicle is incised and implanted into various parts of my head to his experience of where the best place that follicle will look natural. And that's what I am so pleased with, is that the result so far after 8 months is completely natural. You wouldn't know.
Exactly.
Unless I told you.
Sure. All right, let's ask another question. It looks fine now, and you know, you've gone through the told us how, what sort of age you were when you first started thinking about it, etc. Now, I'm sure you're hoping for a long, healthy life. When you're an 80-year-old man, are you going to have the same hair? Or is it kind of going to naturally thin again? How does that work? Because an 80-year-old man with that big head of hair, frankly, might look a bit funny.
Yeah. As Chris said, full honesty and disclosure. Yes, by the time you're 80, there will be some natural hair loss, and that does happen. Is that right, Chris?
Yeah. I mean, essentially, the transplanted hair doesn't seem to be susceptible to, you know, the process of male pattern hair loss. It's almost inevitable, as with everyone, that, you know, we all go on to lose more hair as we get older. And I guess that's the benefit of FUE, follicular unit excision, that, you know, there's not too much to see. So if things, you know, get really thin, you can cut it down pretty short and there's not too much evidence of what's been going on. I suppose that's the sort of worst case scenario. But, you know, the non-surgical side of things, which me and Thomas sort of discussed at length before proceeding, is one of the most important parts of hair restoration surgery. And that's, you know, should I be taking finasteride? Should I be using minoxidil to stabilize my hair and make sure I do get the best long-term aesthetic result? Because that's what we want for all of our patients.
All right. You mentioned a couple of drugs there with drug-like sounding names. What are they? What do they do?
So there's two licensed medications for treating male pattern hair loss in the UK. Number one is oral finasteride. So essentially that's a medication which stops the conversion of testosterone to DHT. DHT is dihydrotestosterone, and that's what's causing that thinning and weakening of the hair. And then you've got minoxidil, and that's a topical preparation. And that works, I think, by increasing blood supply to the scalp. So more of a stimulant than anything else.
Okay. All right. So you need, it's good to increase blood supply to the scalp. So do you recommend sort of after the bedding in period of a couple of weeks, a bit of head massage, that sort of thing? Does that help?
I mean, I'm not sure if there's much evidence for head massage, but yes, I mean, anything that can increase blood supply to the scalp is going to be of benefit. You know, there's some evidence for low level laser therapy post-operatively. But generally speaking, you know, if you stick with the finasteride and the minoxidil, then, you know, they've got great evidence for them. Great evidence.
OK. All right. Now, I'm assuming that this process, which has worked very well for Thomas, this is not available on the NHS, is it?
No.
Or is it?
It is not.
No. So I imagine this is relatively expensive, Thomas.
Relatively, yes. It's like any sort of procedure you choose to have done, which just isn't on the NHS. You know, I am not to be, not to bland around any figures, which I'm not going to do. But you've got to remember, I have got, there's Dr. D'Souza, who is a surgeon, a doctor trained in this country, with his team of surgical assistants. You are in a state-of-the-art clinic in Harley Street. And yes, there is going to be a cost implication to having a professional really look after you. And then, of course, there's all that aftercare as well, which is all encompassed with everything. I mean, you know, when I left after that day in December, Chris gave me his mobile number and said, yeah, call me anytime. I'm here. And, you know, if you feel any problems, that's fine. You know, give us a call, send us some photographs. You know, if you need to come in, just come in and we'll look after you.
So an A1 service, in other words. And actually, Chris,
I couldn't fault it.
Is there an element of pre-op care as well? I mean, have you ever turned patients away because you're thinking, actually, maybe they're not going into this for the wrong reasons and they might just be better off thinking about it for a while?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's so important for any patients who are considering hair transplant surgery to meet with the, you know, operating surgeon well before the day of surgery. You know, there's one of the most important aspects of hair restoration surgery is patient selection, long-term operative planning. So you certainly don't want to rush into a hair transplant. Because as you said, you know, there's many patients who aren't suitable for hair transplant surgery. You know, they may have unrealistic expectations from what they can achieve. Or on the other hand, they may have unstable hair, i.e., you know, the sort of, you know, younger chap, maybe mid-20s, rapidly losing his hair often makes a very poor candidate for surgery because they'll be left with an unnatural pattern. Right. You know, and that all needs to be discussed in detail. And often, going back to the non-surgical side, that should be started well in advance of any surgery being carried out.
Yeah, no, I get it. So the reason for me bringing up potential costs was not to try and create gossip of how much Thomas has spent on his surgery, but to kind of draw attention to the real issue that, you know, this is expensive, potentially expensive, but it's worth paying to get a good service because this, you know, this can go horribly wrong. And in some instances, backstreet hair transplants. You might get people doing this that aren't necessarily particularly well qualified, not in the best position to do it. And you do hear stories of people going overseas to have plastic surgery done and things going horribly wrong. Is that kind of a situation with hair transplants, Chris?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not even not very well qualified. There's, you know, people doing surgery, hair transplant surgery with no medical qualifications at all. Which is ridiculous. I mean, this black market industry seems to have evolved throughout the world, and it's certainly come to the UK, where, you know, very low priced surgery is, of course, you know, a draw to some patients who are financially sensitive. And, you know, hair transplant surgery is a costly procedure. So a lot of patients are drawn in by the package deals of, you know, the flights and the hotels, and the surgery included. But we often operate on patients who have had poor results, and, you know, they explain the fact that, you know, actually, if you think about the cost involved of this plus the remedial work carried out, it ends up being, you know, actually more expensive than what it would have been in the first place.
Sure. And so are there unqualified, poorly qualified hair transplant technicians working in the UK, like backstreet hair transplants in the UK?
Unfortunately, so we are aware of it occurring. It's very, very hard to pin them down. It's very hard to get any real evidence to move that forward. But, you know, that's why it's something I'd like to talk about, because it's, you know, it's all about sort of patient education and making sure people are aware that they specifically ask, you know, who will be doing the surgery, who's making the surgical incisions in my head. A lot of patients that, again, you know,
when you put it like that, who's making the cuts in my head, it kind of focuses the mind a little bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But it's surprising how there's some patients where they don't do their own research. And, you know, I suppose on the day you're in a pretty vulnerable position. And I've had patients say that, you know, I knew something wasn't quite right, but I wasn't sure what it was, and I thought it would probably be okay. And often it is not.
So if you do, I mean, patients that go to these kind of unqualified backstreet hair transplant operations, you can get poor results, i.e. the hair looks a bit funny or it falls out or whatever. Which is bad enough. Can it also be dangerous? I mean, is there another element here that actually, you know, you're putting your health at risk?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose from, you know, the reasons behind why people get hair transplant surgery are many, but for some, it can be, you know, a confidence issue. And they're often left sort of worse off in that regard, where they have a, you know, ruined donor, so they've taken too many grafts on the back and sides, a poorly designed hairline where it's very flat and low with poor density. So, you know, they're actually in a worse off position than you know, they were to begin with. And then, yes, from a medical point of view, you can get complications such as necrosis. So that's death of the skin tissue. So that's when you over harvest. It's a rare complication, but probably the worst complication you can get with hair transplant surgery. So no, I mean, it's a serious medical procedure, and it should be given, you know, it's thought to you know, how and who you're going to get to do it.
Right, very sobering. Right, I've got another question which might come across as a bit of a silly question, so I apologize, but I'm not a health expert at all. I'm just Joe Public as far as this is concerned. So I just ask the questions. This might be a bit of a silly question, but I'll ask it anyway. Getting cells to grow where kind of they haven't been, and wanting, so in this case, kind of hair follicles or what have you, to grow nicely, etc., where they haven't been before. Just the whole business of getting things to grow where they haven't been, arguably where they shouldn't be, strikes me as potentially sometimes a bit serious, because after all, you know, that's what cancer is. Cancer is cells growing where they shouldn't be, dividing where they shouldn't be. Is there any sort of, I can see from the look of your face that this is a silly question, but I'm going to first admit, is getting cells to grow where they haven't been before, is that ever potentially a bit dangerous?
I mean, hair transplant surgery is moving hair from one place to another. So, and you know, we're not really moving it to places where it hasn't been, to be honest. So in Thomas's case, and often with our patients, it's a very subtle sort of natural result which people are looking for. So, you know, we refuse to operate on patients where they say, well, we want a very low straight hairline. You know, it should look nice and natural. No, there's, you know, no medical grounds for what you were sort of referring to. But yeah, I mean, hair transplant surgery is a very safe procedure if it's done correctly with very few complications.
Good. All right. That's the right answer. Thank you. Now, considering everything we've just been talking about, is there kind of a checker trade equivalent, or if you're thinking of having this done, how can you know if the surgeon you're talking to, you know, is properly qualified, or is, as I've kind of rather jokingly said, a bit of a backstreet hair transplant operation?
Yeah. So in the UK, I would expect any decent surgeon to be a member of the British Association of Hair Restoration Surgery. That is our association. And essentially all members are required to adhere to the code of conduct, professional standards, and any patient looking for hair transplant surgery in the UK should certainly seek out a BARS member. There are people that, you know, want to go overseas, and there's some great advice on the BARS website as well for that. Internationally, the International Society of Hair Restoration Surgery. And then there's only one qualification for hair transplant surgery, and that's the American Board diplomat status.
Okay. You touched on it then. I was going to say, if people are listening to this and they want to find out some more information, what's a good resource? You actually mentioned the website then. Can you mention that again, or indeed any other resources?
Yeah. So the British Association of Hair Restoration Surgery website, so www.bars.co.uk. Would be my first port of call. And then you've got the ISHRS as well, which has got some great information on there.
Okay. And lastly, from Thomas, if anyone is listening who's kind of thinking of having this done, you know, will it change your life, make you feel better? What's the advice you would give to someone who's thinking about this?
Oh, if you are thinking about it, it's a no-brainer. Just do it. It's a relatively easy process. Yes, it takes time. You know, I met Chris sort of 18 months ago and had our first meeting. And then, you know, it's taken 18 months to get to this stage. But it is worth starting that ball rolling and exploring all avenues, whether you take finasteride first and then minoxidil to you know, the massage of the hair. And then, if you know, the last resort is the surgery. I have been so pleased and, you know, delighted with the results. I mean, it is, everybody comments, my God, your hair looks amazing. My gosh, your hair looks amazing. You know, people say all the, God, your hair looks good.
Right. You know. So it's definitely worked for you, Thomas. So I think that's going to be the perfect place to finish. So Thomas and Chris, thank you very much indeed for chatting. It's a topic of which I knew nothing. So thank you for educating me. Many thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks to my guests on this week's show. And they were Thomas Forrester of Bargain Hunt and Chris D'Souza, who's a hair transplant surgeon. And of course, a big thanks to you for listening. A big thank you to all the listeners as ever. And if you've got a question or a topic that you would like to be addressed, discussed, analysed or whatever on the show, please do let me know. I think the best way to contact me is my email, which is mike@relaxbackuk.com. Maybe you're an expert on a subject and you would like to be a guest on the show. That's perfectly possible as well. I really am keen for people to ask questions about their health. So if the show has fired some thoughts and some questions that you'd like to ask, please do that. But I say my main objective is to see if I can get people to think about their health, whatever it might be, ask questions of themselves or of their doctor or whoever. If I can manage to do that, then I really am a happy guy. Now, once again, thank you for listening, and please do have a healthy week. Until next week.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Thanks for listening to the Relax Back UK show. Join me, Mike Dilk, again next week for more fascinating interviews and chat. If you're listening to the podcast version, please subscribe, like, and share it with your family and friends. And have a healthy week. Until next week.